stories, Yemen's Ansarullah movement denounces new U.S. sanctions against the group, saying they are an extension to a systematic plan to destroy the Yemeni economy. Venezuela says it has failed to complete a payment for a global program to buy coronavirus vaccines amid U.S. sanctions on the Latin American state. Also ahead, the EU foreign policy chief says the Vienna talks on the revival of the Iran nuclear deal are intense and slow, and there is still a lot of work to be done. Welcome to the program. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has denounced new U.S. sanctions against the group as a new crime against the Yemeni nation. A member of the Supreme Political Council of Yemen said the United States is putting the war option at its first priority while pretending to seek peace. Mohammed Ali al-Houthi said imposing sanctions to bring peace will lead to nowhere. He stressed that the new measures are an extension to a systematic plan aimed at destroying Yemen's economy. The U.S. announced its new sanctions against Ansarullah on Thursday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. will continue to exert pressure on Ansarullah to make it end their offensive in Ma'arib. Ansarullah and its allied army units are engaged in a battle to liberate the city from Saudi-backed forces. Political commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti says the U.S. imposes sanctions on Ansarullah because the movement threatens Washington's policies in the region.
The United States is using the blockade as well as the weapons, and for them to put more sanction on Ansarullah, I don't think this actually will make any difference on Yemeni army advance toward Ma'arib or any coming attack against Saudi Arabia. But as Muhammad Ali al-Houthi said, to force sanction on one side to seek peace, this actually will get you nowhere, because we remember that when Trump administration in the final days, they have put the entire movement, Ansarullah movement, as a terrorist group. This actually has not changed anything. Those sanctions actually is because Ansarullah is against U.S. Foreign policy, and because it shows that Ansarullah is the only group in Yemen that is actually threatened the U.S. and the Zionist and the Saudi policy in the region. Right. And this actually is a kind of honor for them to be sanctioned by the United States.
Venezuela says it's been unable to complete payments for COVAX, the global COVID-19 vaccine program, because the payments were blocked.
Venezuela paid the full installment required by COVAX, but the last four payments amounting to $10 were blocked, and this is how COVAX informs us, where it says, in relation to the four payments mentioned, I confirm that we have received a notification from UBS Bank that the payments have been blocked and are under investigation.
Venezuela's vice president has blamed the U.S. She said the U.S.-backed financial system has the power to block resources that can be used to immunize the Venezuelan nation. The country is now denied access to 11 million doses of COVID vaccines. Caracas secured them in March after months of diplomatic efforts. Venezuela has also used Russian and Chinese jabs to make up for vaccine shortages caused by financial restrictions put by the U.S. Latin American nation has reported more than 246,700 COVID cases, nearly 2,800 deaths. India has reported more than 91,700 new COVID-19 cases in the past 24 hours. The figure brings India's total case tally to more than 29 million. Its COVID deaths passed 363,000 after more than 3,400 new deaths were posted in the past 24 hours. India was struggling with a devastating second wave of coronavirus in April and May. That caused daily infections to reach their peak of more than 400,000 last month. Strict lockdowns and vaccinations helped contain the surge. Now, daily new cases have remained below 100,000 over the past several days.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hampered India's ambition of double-digit growth by 2022. In its latest report, the World Bank has slashed the country's growth forecast to 8.3% from 10.1% estimated earlier. The service sector is the hardest hit, the report added, stressing on higher spending on infrastructure, rural development and healthcare. The ongoing economic turmoil sparked by COVID pandemic has dragged millions in poverty and unemployment.
The damage was already done with the COVID first wave, but whatever was left, second wave devastated it further. It is very hard to find work these days because there is less activity in construction sector.
In recent weeks, the government announced a set of policies related to spending after a pandemic deteriorated the economic prospectus. The central bank also announced measures for micro, small and medium businesses. Over the last few months, India has been struggling with a ferocious second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic with around 400,000 daily cases and thousands of deaths. Hospitals were reeling under shortage of space, oxygen, beds and vaccines. This prompted the government to announce more stringent lockdowns, which resulted in huge economic costs for the world's second most populous nation, where millions rely on daily wages. Migrant workers were the hardest hit.
No matter what it is, the poor people are the ones who struggle most. Rich people have savings, they can survive. But what about us? The second wave has finished everything we had. If these lockdowns continue, we will die.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism over handling COVID crisis. The pandemic with economic slowdown has devastated the livelihood of millions in India. The country is also staring at an unemployment crisis, with youth being the worst affected. Observers say to counter slowing economy and unemployment crisis, India needs to launch more stimulus packages and job support schemes the way other developed nations did after COVID ravaged their economies. But fear of third wave in India is creating further doubts if the country is ready to deal with another looming situation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The European Union's foreign policy chief says talks to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal are intense and slow. Joseph Borrell said the EU is working on what he calls a non-stop basis to revive the accord in all its aspects. His comments came as the remaining signatories to the international agreement are set to meet in the Austrian capital, Vienna, on Saturday for the sixth round of talks. According to the diplomats participating in the talks, disagreements persist about a few key issues. Negotiations are being held on a possible U.S. return to the deal known as the JCPOA and the complete removal of sanctions against Iran. Author and journalist Danielle Lazar says the U.S. is reluctant to come back to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and remove anti-Tehran sanctions.
Well, I've always been very pessimistic about the prospect of the U.S. re-entering the JCPOA. The U.S., the Congress is dominated by anti-Iran hardliners, and the administration is on tacking on extra issues to the JCPOA, and it's extremely reluctant to remove anti-Iran sanctions. So for that reason, I think I doubt the talks will go anywhere very soon. They really don't want an agreement. They want to push for the economic strangulation of Iran, a rollback of Iranian power, and a further tipping of the balance of power in the Middle East towards Saudi Arabia and especially towards Israel. The U.S. has been firm on this issue. It was firm under the Trump administration, and now with the stance is equally hard on the Biden administration.
As Election Day approaches in Iran, presidential candidates intensify their campaigns so that they can woo more voters this year. Most of the campaigns are conducted and aired on state media in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. The candidates are allowed to hold physical electoral campaigns with limited numbers. Yusuf Jaloli reports.
The June 18th presidential vote draws to a close in Iran, and candidates are on a tight schedule, trying to make the best of the remaining time to attract more public support. In addition to televised campaigns, candidates now visit universities and other key places to increase their popularity among people from different walks of life.
When I make a promise, I'll give you a clear roadmap that shows every step of my plan. For example, if I promise to solve the issue of housing, I will give you the exact timeline of the procedure and the number of houses that I will build for the people who don't have a house.
We try to analyze the current state of affairs in Iran and create plans that are based on real circumstances of our society. We concluded that we could make tangible changes based on our plans.
All of the seven contenders have rich executive backgrounds, from sitting atop the judicial branch to running the Central Bank of Iran. But perhaps their past plays the least part in winning the race, since it's what they plan for the future that matters to voters.
I have a special plans regarding the exchange market. I believe that the capital market plays a significant role in financing the countries in this race.
If I took office, I would eliminate the coronavirus once and for all within less than 6 months. I also have comprehensive health policies that would reduce the costs significantly for patients.
We do have plans, but we cannot break them down to their details during a limited time of campaigns. God willing, if I'm elected president, I will operate those plans.
Aside from electoral campaigns, which are mostly held in the form of televised addresses, the candidates face off in live debates. So far, the seven runners have attended two televised debates. The first was themed with economy, and the second centered on social affairs. The third and final showdown is slated for June 12th. Unlike previous rounds where the elections were more of a clash of the parties, this time it's a race of plans. Plans that can ensure a better economy and a brighter future for Iranians. Yusuf Jaloli, Tehran.
Presidential candidate Mohsen Rezai says Tehran should not wait for any agreement in the Vienna talks that aim to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Rezai made the comment in an exclusive interview with Press TV. He said Americans should know that the more they waste time in returning to the nuclear agreement, the more they will lose. Rezai said Washington should realize that Tehran will never go back to one-sided ties that existed prior to the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He added his possible administration would welcome any relations that serve Iran's national interests in practice, not on paper. Rezai also said if elected president, he would resolve differences with neighboring countries. He also pledged to keep the country moving forward by activating its national economy. Presidential candidate Saeed Jalili says if elected president, he will provide the necessary budget to resolve problems surrounding Iran's educational system. Jalili is critical of the current administration for failing to provide necessary facilities to hard-up areas in the country south. The 55-year-old candidate called for what he called cultural diplomacy, adding that necessary privileges have been granted to minorities across the country to fill the gaps between ethnic groups. In regards to foreign policy, Mr. Jalili says the next president has to have a good knowledge of the region and the world.
The one who becomes president has to know the region and the world as well as ties between countries. Making a mistake will put you on a wrong track. In the Muslim world, we have various capabilities for which there should be a different plan and approach on different levels. This policy differs depending on which governments, which political ideological currents, or what nations you're dealing with. Each of them needs a specific agenda for you to be able to deal with.
Presidential candidate Alireza Zakani has outlined his economic plan in an interview. He says supporting the low-income deciles of the society the size of the society that should be, and single mothers is his top priority. Zakani said he will also tackle unemployment and pay cash handouts to the unemployed to help families make ends meet.
In my government, 25 million low-income Iranians will receive free medical care, and the low-income deciles of society will not have to pay for treatment. My government will also provide subsidy cards to 69 million Iranians to help them make ends meet. The future government of the country must create conditions for the maximum welfare of the people. There are currently 3,500,000 single mothers in the country, and supporting them is one of my top priorities. There are 2.5 million unemployed people in the country. My government, while creating suitable conditions for training job skills to these people, will also pay a monthly allowance of 1.2 million tomans to unemployed people.
Meanwhile, presidential candidate Amir Hossein Qazizadeh Hashemi has briefly outlined his plans for different provinces in the country. He says each city needs to be able to offer services similar to those being offered in the capital. Qazizadeh also made some comments regarding diplomacy, saying foreign policy must be mainly focused on the economy.
It is very important for the governments to have plans for each province, aside from those for the country as a whole. My government's provincial plans include assigning greater responsibilities to local governors. We have a model based on which all of our cities will be similar to Tehran, and therefore people would not need to travel to the capital for particular services. We also want diplomacy for the economy and nothing else. The foreign ministry is most valuable to us when it manages to pave the way for economic exchanges with other countries.
And that's it with international news.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Beijing wants the U.S. and the West to know that its coming legal retaliation against perceived as unjust sanctions is supported by its people, says Jeff Pao, journalist, in an article titled China to Fire Back at U.S. Sanctions. Stay tuned for more. China will soon pass a law to strike back against the countries that have imposed sanctions on Chinese state organs, enterprises, organizations, and functionaries, including those with links to the People's Liberation Army. New draft legislation dubbed the Anti-Foreign Sanctions Law was submitted to the National People's Congress, NPC, Standing Committee for a second reading recently. It is expected that the draft will be approved by the top legislative body in China soon. The details of the draft have not been made public. However, according to a Xinhua report, the Chinese government will launch multiple corresponding countermeasures against entities and individuals in relevant countries, meaning the United States, from the beginning of 2021. During the two sessions in early March, some members of the NPC and Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, CPPCC, suggested it was necessary for China to formulate a specific law to counter foreign sanctions. Members of the NPC Standing Committee reviewed the draft for the first time in a meeting in late April and broadly agreed to formulate the law to counter foreign sanctions. They also gave some advice and suggestions on improving the draft, Xinhua reported. For some time, out of political manipulation needs and ideological bias, some Western countries have used Xinjiang and Hong Kong-related issues as part of their pretext to spread rumors on and smear, contain and suppress China, according to the spokesperson office of the Legislative Affairs Commission of the NPC Standing Committee. In particular, the countries, in violation of international law and the basic norms governing international relations, have imposed so-called sanctions on relevant Chinese state organs, organizations, and functionaries in accordance with their domestic laws, grossly interfering in China's internal affairs, added the spokesperson. The office said China would use the new law to safeguard national sovereignty, dignity, and core interests, and oppose Western hegemonism and power politics. Last July, then U.S. President Donald Trump issued an executive order to end Hong Kong's special status with the U.S. and signed into law a bill to impose sanctions on a dozen Hong Kong and Chinese officials, including Chief Executive Carrie Lam. It was reported that some banks had canceled Lam's accounts, forcing the Hong Kong leader to keep her money in cash at home. Lam said it was a tad inconvenient using only cash, but it was an honor for her to be able to safeguard national security. Last December, the Trump administration sanctioned 14 vice chairmen of the NPC over their role in Beijing tightening its grip on Hong Kong and in setting policies for Xinjiang. Beijing later imposed sanctions of its own, targeting some U.S. officials and congressmen. Ahead of a meeting between the U.S. and China's top officials in Alaska in March, the Biden administration announced it would sanction more Chinese officials. In the same month, Guo Shiqing, chairman of the China Banking and Insurance Regulatory Commission, said all financial institutions in Hong Kong would not implement the U.S. sanctions but had to enforce Chinese laws and regulations. Charles Ho Tsu Kwok, a Hong Kong businessman and one of the 18 members of the CPPCC Standing Committee, said in an interview with Hong Kong's commercial radio recently that Chief Executive Lam should be blamed for lacking knowledge, experience and vision when handling the anti-extradition saga in 2019. Citing the comment made by the then-Chinese ambassador to the United Kingdom, Liu Xiaoming, in June 2019, Ho said it was Lam's idea instead of Beijing's order to launch the extradition law legislation. Ho said he had warned Lam that such a move would lead to foreign sanctions, but she refused to listen to his advice. Ho said although Lam was also sanctioned by the U.S., her personal loss was insignificant when compared to that of the business sector, which lost a lot of trade benefits after U.S. revoked Hong Kong's special status last year. Lam said people enjoyed the right to comment on the government and its governance as Hong Kong was a place with freedom of speech. She said she and her team would continue to listen to people's advice in a humble manner and try their best to finish the tasks within the last year of her current term. During the two sessions in March, the NPC Standing Committee said its main tasks in the coming year included enriching the legal toolkit with a focus on moves against sanctions and interference and countering long-arm jurisdiction to cope with challenges and risks. Deng Yuwen, a U.S.-based Chinese scholar and a researcher at the China Strategic Analysis Center, told RTHK that it seemed to be lacking legitimacy when the Chinese government counteracted foreign sanctions with diplomatic means in the past. Deng said the launch of the anti-foreign sanctions law would increase the legitimacy of Chinese sanctions and also send a message to the West that China's retaliation against foreign sanctions was supported by the Chinese people. However, Deng said the new law would not make much difference in real practice. Wu Qiang, a Beijing-based independent political commentator, said the launch of anti-foreign sanctions law was aimed at retaliating against U.S. sanctions imposed on 14 vice chairmen of the NPC and to show Chinese President Xi Jinping's fighting spirit. Wu said after the law was passed, China would impose sanctions on foreign people, companies, and governments whenever it faced foreign sanctions. He said some foreign trade and cooperation partnerships would be affected.
The debate.
The discovery of remains of 215 children, some as young as three, at a former residential school in Canada has reopened wounds among the indigenous survivors of colonial Canadian schools. Yet, when it comes to condemning Canada, condemnations were very far and in between. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the depth of this problem in Canada and why the indigenous community and First Nation people continue to be discriminated and traumatized even to this day.
The last month's discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for indigenous students in Canada has reopened old wounds and fueled outrage in the country about the lack of information and accountability regarding violations of indigenous people's rights. On the weekend, thousands of Canadians took to the streets in Toronto to call for greater action from the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the country's infamous residential school system.
What they need to do is acknowledge that this was a wrong. What Trudeau doesn't want to acknowledge that it was a genocide. But there's actually been five genocides, the fifth one ongoing.
Demonstrators also tore down the statue of Egerton Ryerson, one of the architects of the residential school system at a Toronto university named after him. Following the discovery of the mass grave at a site of Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, Trudeau said it was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter in Canada's history and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility for its role in such schools. Pope Francis expressed his pain over the discovery, but stopped short of offering a direct apology.
I follow with pain the news coming from Canada about the shocking discovery of the remains of 215 children, pupils of the Kamloops Indian Residential School in the province of British Columbia. I join the Canadian bishops and the entire Catholic Church in Canada in expressing my closeness to the Canadian people traumatized by the shocking news. The sad discovery further raises awareness of the pains and sufferings of the past.
Indigenous leaders and school survivors, however, dismissed the Pope's expression of pain, saying the Church needs to do much more. Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend boarding schools which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into the white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages while experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at Canada's residential schools, but efforts continue to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that a country committed, quote, cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Besides, reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. It has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. Nonetheless, the discovery of the bodies at a former boarding school and lack of meaningful action on the issue of missing women and girls have raised serious questions about such claims.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, joins us from Ontario. We also have lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Edward Corrigan, let me first start with you. I mean, we did cover what happened in this tragic incident, but why don't you give us a quick wrap-up as to what actually occurred?
Well, there was a deliberate policy to assimilate the natives' children. They felt that the adult indigenous people were not, couldn't be changed, but if they take the children, and the quote was to kill the Indian in the child. So children were ordered and taken from their families and forced to go to these schools. As many as 150,000 children were there, 138 schools. And, you know, the conditions were horrific. They were, they were cold, they were not proper ventilation. They would put children who were sick with tuberculosis in with the other children, so that at one school, I read that 69% of the children died. And they estimate that around 25% of the children who attended the schools did die, but they don't have proper record keeping. The 215 children's bodies that were found in Kamloops, it's just the tip of the iceberg. There's other schools where they found 15 bodies, and I think if they were to examine, you know, the other schools, 138 schools, they would also find bodies there. They're buried in unmarked graves. They're not properly looked after. The families, in many cases, were not notified of the death of their children. It was just silence. And this is, you know, government policy, government funding, run by the churches, and they were trying to, you know, force them to convert to Christianity. They punished them if they spoke the native language. They either have to speak English or French. And it really was like a penal colony. And you have, you know, horrific treatment. And, of course, it didn't work. You know, the native children didn't have the skills to compete yet they were also torn away from their own societies and cultures and couldn't even maybe communicate with their parents because they knew English or French, but the parents did not. They only spoke indigenous language. So it is horrific that how these natives were treated. And it was based upon sort of the aggressive assimilation policy that was employed in the United States by General Ulysses Grant. But yeah, this is a really dark, terrible history, chapter in Canada's history.
It really is, and I'm looking down at some of the things that confirms some of the statements that you made there. And Jonathan Levy, I'd like to find out from you, why were they targeted in such a form and manner? Why, for example, would the church or the residential school system forcibly separate these First Nation children from their families? But in essence, why were they being targeted?
Well, as Mr. Corrigan pointed out, there was a genocidal policy behind it. But in addition, there was already a policy in Canada of contracting with the Catholic Church to provide social services, and the provinces made money. They were paid money by the federal government. In the case of Quebec, 100,000 children went through orphanages and institutions. Some were First Nations people, and some were just simply from disadvantaged families. And the Catholic Church used them for medical experimentation, administered electroshock because they would be paid more money if the children were labeled psychiatric cases. And this went on for 20, 30 years in Quebec. And we're still trying to locate, you know, the mass graves from there. We know where some of them are. The group is called the Duplessis Orphans, and that's a subset of the larger problem in Canada and the terrible problem with the Catholic Church providing social services and everybody making money from it. It was not just genocide, but a corrupt financial bargain between some of the provincial governments and the Catholic Church.
Okay. Again, I'm trying to get to the origins of how this all came about. So you have these First Nation children, and then you have the church, which is supposed to obviously spell religion, come and take them away from their parents and commit some of the most brutal acts that both you, both of our guests here have talked about. Jonathan Levy, you mentioned it, and Edward Corrigan, you also. It doesn't quite make sense as to why a church would do that, why they would do experiments on these children to go to that extreme. And it comes back to my question as to why they were being targeted in this form and manner. Edward Corrigan, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, it's basically racism. And the English settlers and the French settlers that came here thought that their society was superior to the natives. And the churches thought the same, and they wanted to take the children away from their indigenous beliefs, which were considered pagan, and turn them into Christians. And this was done, you know, in horrific ways through punishment. If the parents didn't release the children, they weren't able to get baby bonuses. And during this period, actually, Indians had no right to vote. If they got, you know, professional skills, they were removed, taken away from, you know, Indian status. They were, these experiments on food. There's a whole pile of different experiments where they would keep a test group and keep them, you know, malnourished, then try to have another group of children that would have different, you know, higher and better food. But it was, you know, it said, you look at these, it looks like terrible prison conditions of the worst kind. And, you know, the children were all packed in together. And so if one child had tuberculosis or any other diseases, it would spread to all the other children. So, you know, very high numbers of diseases affected the kids. And of course, many children died because they had inadequate food, inadequate health care, inadequate ventilation. And everything about this was a disaster. And the more numbers they had, the more money they got. But there was not enough money to look after the children properly. And, you know, the federal government provided some money, the province, you know, the province has control over education, but not with regard to the Indians. They were considered wards of the federal government, but they never were properly looked after. So you have these, you know, horrific memories being dragged back because of the discovery of the 215 graves. But there's, you know, probably, you know, 6,000 or more graves like this, and many people, they don't know who is buried there. And there's this, you know, these children just sort of disappeared. People ran away from the schools because they're so horrific, and they were punished severely if that happened. But the families weren't told, in many cases, you know, if their child died, and they were sent away from populated areas to try to minimize the contact between the families and the children, and this sort of aggressive assimilation project to turn, you know, the natives into, you know, good little, you know, English-speaking citizens or French-speaking citizens. And, you know, they were, you know, up until, as you know, 1996 was the last school that closed, which is not that long ago. So this period, and, you know, there were periodic reports, and the Truth and Reconciliation report was is very, very important. And it, you know, termed that what was treated, how the Indian children were treated and the natives were treated was cultural genocide. So I agree with that. But, you know, this is over, you know, barely 25 years ago, and there was no punishment. You know, they're unmarked graves, and they build over stuff. And, you know, it's when they were putting in a water line, and they uncovered 15 bodies at one school. So there are many, many schools, and people estimate that perhaps as many 25% of the children who attended these schools ended up dying, you know, primarily of disease. But there was sexual abuse, physical abuse, and, you know, social and psychological abuse was all part and parcel of this attempt to assimilate the Indians and natives of indigenous people.
Okay, so we have expanded on that as much as we can. So we have an idea about the horrific experiences that these kids had. But could the possibility, Jonathan Levy, be that this is all about land? We know that Canada asserted control over indigenous people and lands. It was just in 1985 when the indigenous people were viewed as citizens. So this is very recent. And I'm just trying to connect the dots here. If it's related in any sense that they are taking the kids away because these lands would eventually be transferred to the kids. But without the kids, then you have the adults that they have to deal with, which at some point they're going to pass away. Of course, then you have restrictions, you have discrimination exercised against them. Is that an outlook or a way to look at this situation?
Sadly, in Canada, there's been a lot of institutional abuse, and finances have also been, you know, the motivation. So, yeah, if you're committing genocide against a people, the idea is you are going to try to diminish them and perhaps take their land, which has always been a problem with the First Nations people. And of course, the entire institutional system with orphans in Canada was based on making money from the federal government. So there was a very strong profit motive involved. And, you know, the people involved should be punished both financially and morally for what they've done. Because, again, some of it was indeed trying to perhaps change the Indians into something they were not. But really, when you look at it, it was genocide. And the idea of genocide is to extinguish people.
Well, what about the Canadian government here, Edward Corrigan? I'm looking at the figure over here that the government had, committed to back in 2019. We can go and check that stat out. $28.1 million was just allocated. It was $33.8 million was allocated for this. But out of that figure, $27.1 million has yet to be spent. Why is the Canadian president, who in his speeches does talk about the indigenous people and how they're being victimized, but not doing really much about it, as he's been criticized for?
Well, there was a $1.9 billion compensation fund that was set up by the federal government to compensate, you know, Indian Native children who were in the residential school system. They got $10,000 for if they were there for a year or part of a year, and then $3,000 for each additional year. But they had to sign a release that there would not be any other claim of compensation against the government or the churches. They did have some exemptions for, you know, sexual abuse and severe physical abuse, but this was a way of trying to hide the real extent of the problem and give, what is probably fairly limited compensation for the treatment that these, children received. Now, the Catholic Church has not formally apologized for its treatment. The Anglican Church, the United Church, and the Presbyterian Church have, in fact, apologized. But the Catholic Church was the largest provider of these schools, in Quebec, across Canada. There's, set over 138 of these schools. And you have, it was sort of a sick system. People were sick. They were put to school, even if they were dying. And of course, if they have a disease that's contagious, it immediately gets spread to the other students that are in these close confined quarters. And it's it is really sad when you're reading about these reports. You can't believe how bad it was. And there were some people who did try to solve the problem, and there was some talk of even getting rid of the reserve system. The reserve system in Canada actually is kind of like a system of apartheid, where the Indians keep on land, and the South African government at one point came up to study the reserve system in Canada to use it as a model for their own system of apartheid in South Africa. And I think that's a shocking revelation. If you think most Canadians would not say, oh, we never had apartheid, we're good, we treat people properly. But unfortunately, it's the opposite of the case. There was really brutal treatment of these children. And, cultural genocide, bordering on, physical genocide. And the orphans were taken away from the children, or even if they had parents, and were put up for adoption. There's 20-plus thousand people were put through the orphan system. And, it's a really sad, sad chapter of Canada's history. Now, hopefully, the federal government will, take responsibility and also put the money in so that they can identify who, in fact, is buried in these unmarked graves and provide some sort of compensation and closure for the families.
Well, right now, the Canadian Prime Minister is actually, Jonathan Levy, criticizing the Catholic Church, aside from what our guest there, Edward Corrigan, says about the closure, that responsibility being in the hands of the government. The church is supposed to come out, is supposed to take some responsibility here based on what the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said. And there's been a lot of critique leveled against the Pope that he has not come out with apology really on this, and for the for that institution to take responsibility. Why do you think that is?
There's clearly duplicity involved here between both Trudeau and the Pope. The Canadian government can hold the Catholic Church through their various orders in Canada responsible if it had the will to do so. So what you're seeing here is the Canadian government can blame the church. The church doesn't apologize. The Canadian government says, well, we can't resolve this because the church isn't cooperating. The church knows where the graves are, where the grave sites are, and they're working behind the scenes, hand in glove, both of them trying to avoid greater liability. The Canadian government has done a settlement with some of the native peoples, but there is a similar problem with non-native peoples who were forced into orphanages run by the church for the profit motive. So that's why it's a duplicitous game between Trudeau and the Pope. The Pope is sort of, they're bouncing it off each other, neither one wanting to take responsibility. And indeed, the Catholic Church has escaped liability almost altogether in these matters. And they own vast tracts of land. They have the resources to make a settlement. And they're not accountable to anyone, even though Trudeau could hold them accountable if he wanted to.
Okay. In less than a minute, Edward Corrigan, discrimination against Indigenous people still happens. Is it being addressed properly? Or is there a lack of this issue being addressed within Canada? Under a minute.
It's not being addressed properly because you still have, much higher incarceration rates for the native population. And, you have alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, a whole pile of psychiatric disorders, which stem from actually the residential school system, plus, racism against our Indigenous population. I think one of the reasons why the Catholic Church doesn't want to give a formal apology is that because of legal liability, if they're admitting that they're responsible, that would be a strong base upon which to launch lawsuits against the, you know, the Catholic Church and other churches. Okay. So the church is concerned about that. They want to limit their legal liability, but I think they should really take responsibility for this horrific period in the treatment of our indigenous people.
Indeed. Thank you so much. We're going to end with the international human rights lawyer, Edward Corrigan. Thank you for your comments, and lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy there from London. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. So thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I've been Kavita Hui.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all over the world, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from series of The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to talk about, or let's say answer, some doubts or misconceptions on the important issue of Mahdaviya or Mahdism. For this, we have invited, as usual, Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminar Schools to answer our questions that we pose here. The question that we want to ask from his presence is about the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the events that will happen after his reappearance. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Many thanks, Sheikh, for accepting the invitation to the show. The first question and the question of the day that I want to ask it from you, Sheikh, is about the time that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam reappears. And it is being said that after his reappearance, he will destroy and ruin the house of God, the Kaaba, and Masjid al-Haram. Is it true, Sheikh? And if yes, what is the source? If not, what is the root, or what are the roots of such doubts?
As you mentioned, it's been raised, this doubt, by some of the Wahhabi scholars. They have referred to one narration in Shia sources, and they have claimed that Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, when he comes, he will destroy Masjid al-Haram and Masjid al-Nabi in Mecca and Medina, and will destroy the Kaaba, and of course will rebuild them. I mean, Masjid al-Haram, Kaaba, and Masjid al-Nabi, and will put them on their original place. Mm-hmm. Now, when we refer to the source, it is true, we have...
So it's not destruction, Sheikh, in the sense that you are talking about. It's sort of rebuilding.
Exactly. This is one of the points that we want to emphasize, that even if it will happen, it would be because of rebuilding, not just destroying.
Or reconstruction.
Exactly, reconstruction. But first of all, this narration, based on the chain of the narration, is a weak narration. It's been mentioned in Kitab al-Ghiba, page 472, but the chain of the narration is not authentic, so we can say that we can get rid of this doubt and question altogether. But let's analyze the content of the narration and see if it is true or not. The first point is that we see that it's been mentioned in some of the narrations in Sunni sources that the Holy Prophet wished to destroy Kaaba and reconstruct it again. Mm-hmm. Because we know that after being built by Prophet Ibrahim and Ismail alayhi salam, and even before that, Kaaba has gone through different changes during the history. It's been, in some cases, destroyed a part of it and reconstructed again. I don't want to say that these narrations are true or not, but the point is that this Wahhabi scholar refers to one weak Shia narration to claim that Mahdi will destroy the Kaaba, but the point is that it's been mentioned in Sunni sources as well as a wish of the Prophet. Let me share one narration, for example. It's been mentioned in Sahih Bukhari, volume 2, page 156, Sahih Muslim, volume 4, page 97, and many other Sunni sources. In one narration, Aisha narrates that the Holy Prophet once told me, Hatim, which is referring to Hijr Ismail, and we know that today Hijr Ismail is outside the Kaaba, it's not inside the Kaaba.
That's true.
Now, according to this narration, the Holy Prophet says Hijr Ismail is and was a part of Kaaba, but for some reasons, they put it outside the Kaaba. And because of the fact that these Arabs are very close to the era of Jahiliyyah, I wish to destroy Kaaba and reveal the columns which were built by Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam and put Hijr Ismail inside the Kaaba.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Holy Prophet concludes, if I be alive for another year, I will do that. Again, I don't want to say that it is a true narration, authentic narration or not. But it's been mentioned, for example, in Asirat al-Halabiyyah, volume 1, page 288.
Yeah.
And Ibn al-Kathir, the famous Sunni scholar, after narrating this narration, says that this narration has been mentioned in different books of hadith by Sunni scholars from Aisha. It's in Al-Bidayah wal-Nihayah, volume 8, page 289. So you see, according to this narration, the Holy Prophet also wanted to destroy the Kaaba and rebuild it and reconstruct it based on the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. So it's weird to attribute that to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and consider it a weak point for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This is not the case. This has been a wish of the Prophet according to this narration.
By this doubt that this person actually has brought up, the thing that comes to the mind of a listener of such quotes is that he's coming just to destroy it, not to, as you said, not to rebuild and reconstruct it. I think it is good to be to enlighten the brothers and sisters who are listening to us. This is not actually in the sense to destroy it, to say that there is no, exactly, from now on there is not going to be any Masjid al-Haram. No. In case, even if this weak narration, as you said, and you talked about the credentials and also authentication of the hadith, in case, in, let's say, suppose the impossible, it is true, then it has nothing to do with destruction at all. It is sort of reconstruction is going to happen. Thank you, Sheikh.
It is interesting to know that it's been mentioned by one of the Sunni scholars called Sarakhsi that this narration of the Prophet was so famous that at the time of Abdullah ibn Zubayr, he wanted to act upon this prophetic narration. So he revealed those columns built by Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, and he put Hijr Ismail inside the Kaaba. This is the report of Sarakhsi. But when Abdullah ibn Zubayr was killed, Hajjaj, who was unhappy with this act of ibn Zubayr, again destroyed that part and put the Kaaba as it is right now. This is in Al-Mafsud, volume 4, page 11. As Shia, can we say that you see the Sunnis wanted to damage the Holy Kaaba and destroy Masjid al-Haram? No, this is not the case. We are not doing that by referring to these narrations in Sunni sources. As you mentioned, even if these narrations are true, they are referring to the fact that the Holy Prophet wanted to rebuild it based on the tradition and the structure at the time of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. And if Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to do so again, it is because of rebuilding the Kaaba. This is the first point.
Very true.